This week on Life and Faith.
Women can be gentle, but at the same time, they are very strong. And they are very empathetic. They understand people much better. They feel with them. And that's very, very essential for a leader.
I would not have ended on this path that I find myself on now if it wasn't for the new atheists.
People want to set themselves apart from the evil that has existed in the world and exists now.
I mean, it's crazy.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Well, imagine none of us can forget those scenes from Afghanistan in 2021 after the withdrawal of all NATO forces and the collapse of the government as the Taliban took control of the country. The desperate scenes of people trying to escape were hard to watch, the fear and the panic so obvious. And we've talked about different aspects of that story here on Life and Faith before. Asuntha Charles is from India, but was working with World Vision in Afghanistan at the time. She had had a few different stints in Afghanistan over many years and regarded it as her second home. Well, as aid workers were getting out of the country in droves, she decided to stay and ended up being the only foreigner left on the team of 700 that she led. What is it that would lead someone to make a decision like that? We'll find out today. Asuntha Charles has been an advocate for voiceless people, especially women and girls, her whole life, in India initially and then in various parts of the world. She works for World Vision and was recently in Australia with MICA Australia, launching the A Safer World for All campaign. She came into the studio to talk about her work and her life. I began our conversation by asking her about the person she considers her first advocate and why her mother's courage so impacted the shape of Asuntha's life.
When she was expecting, my mother had a serious illness. So, and the doctors had to advise her to abort me. And the entire family felt that it was good for health because there were other children to look after. So they all agreed that they would abort me so that my mother would be saved. But my mother said, no, I'm not going to give up my child. I'm going through this pregnancy and I will make sure that I will deliver this baby. And I think she made the right choice.
Well, it's a choice we're all glad of now. But that's a huge thing, isn't it?
Yeah, Mum. Yeah.
In that space where the opinions seem to be one direction, that's a very brave thing she did for you.
Yeah, and she's from a very traditional family. So she always obeyed what my father said, what the elders said, especially what the in-laws said. But at that time, she took a courageous decision to say no to everyone. And many were not happy with her. But luckily, she lived till 84. So right. That shows she made the right decision. So I always think she's my first model advocate.
And tell us about growing up in Chennai, right?
Yeah.
What was it like as a little girl in that place?
Being from a traditional family, it was always that I had to fight for my own rights, even at home, like to be going for higher education or even going for work. Everything was very difficult because the family had certain practices to follow and they thought every child should really spontaneously follow that and nobody should be against it. And honestly, in every moment, wherever I had to make a lot of different decisions, like wanted to go up for a higher studies, it was my mother who always stood by me. And I always say, for whatever I am here today, it's because of my mother. And she was not really fighting with my father. She had her own way of telling things that made things very easy. And she convinced my father. And today, I think most of my lobby work, I draw inspiration from my mother.
Isn't that fascinating? So she's a persuader.
Yeah.
And you've become...
She wouldn't give up.
You've become that as well.
Yeah.
There had to be resistance in order for you to be educated in the way that you became educated. Tell us a bit about that and how that happened. How did you get through to that point where you were going to be educated in a way that perhaps a lot of other girls would not have been?
Yeah, after completing my studies, usually like my two elder sisters got married after they finished their studies. So then... That's the pattern, how things were done at home. So my father said, once you finish your studies, maybe I think we should start looking for a boy so that you get married.
Yeah.
Then I said, I think I want to continue my studies. And I brought in Mother Teresa into my support and said, I like Mother Teresa. I want to be like her, doing some charitable work for the children, taking care of the poor, taking care of the sick. That convinced them a little bit. So they said, okay, she has a heart for the poor. And that's nice. Let's allow her. That's how I could really move into the direction.
You invoked the Mother Teresa card. And the people and family was a little bit open to that.
So then they allowed me to do my studies, master's in social work. I finished my master's in social work. So that really helped me. And somewhere, I think after hearing my story from my mother, like how I was born, I thought I was getting a passion for my life. And I thought my life has some purpose. So then I began to think and dream of doing something. And that's how even my studies was around social work. So I thought maybe that's where I want to do something for the society.
Yeah, where did that come from, that interest in caring for people who were in need of it? Where do you think it comes from for you?
Like, I was born and brought up in a Catholic family. So though we were very traditional, but it was a loving family. We could really think of supporting the neighbors, and both my parents were very good at it. Even though it was a middle-class family, we didn't have much to share with others, but whatever we had, my parents were always willing to share with other people. So I think that was somewhere in me, which really made me to see that as my career.
You went on to work with particularly Indigenous girls, I think I'm right in saying. Tell me a bit about that work and what the work involved and what you were trying to achieve.
After my studies, I started these Indigenous people's movements and also movements that were working for Dalit rights, because you know caste plays a bigger role in India.
Yeah, so just so people understand that, so the Dalit class, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, India follows a very, very hierarchical system where some are very high in the society. They are considered to be the topmost people who have all the privileges. And there are different sectors where are totally deprived of their rights. Hmm. And the lowest ones are the Dalits. So they are treated as untouchables. So they are not given any rights. So they have to be really like slaves. Hmm. So my life started with fighting for their rights, especially for the rights of women. Even among Dalits, women are vulnerable. So I started working for the rights of Dalit women and Indigenous people because their land rights was a big challenge in India. Yep. They were living in forest, but the natural producers were not given to them. So that is how I started becoming an advocate or a voice of those voiceless people. So it was like mostly a lot of protests, a lot of dharnas, sitting on the streets, demanding what people need. So it was most kind of a right-based work that I started liking.
Yes, and presumably you're up against a whole cultural system there. So were there any memorable gains that you were able to achieve that you can remember?
Yeah, in some places where Dalits were not given homes, like houses were not built for them, they used to be living in huts. And most of the time these huts were burned down, and especially during the elections, before elections. And so we wanted real good houses for these people to stay on. So we were able to get houses for Dalits and land rights, because many of them could really work as farmers, but they didn't have land. And they had land which was taken away by the upper caste people. So we had to fight back and get back the land. So in many cases, we were really moving in the right direction. And it was done by the people. So it was together. It was a real wonderful experience.
So you go on amongst other things, and I mean, you've led this amazing life, so we won't be able to cover it all, but you did end up working in Afghanistan for some time. I wanted to know a little bit about that experience, what you were doing there, your life there. Tell us a bit about that.
Actually, that was a beautiful step in my life. I was managing the tsunami response in India for Oxfam Netherlands. So when I finished my assignment and when the program was closed, then my manager asked me, can you take up an international career? So I was very happy, like not even moving out of my state, but now I have an opportunity to move out of the country. Mm-hmm. So I said very happily, I accepted the offer and I said, yes, I would go. But I didn't know what I was accepting for. It was for Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first international exposure. But today I call Afghanistan as my second home because of the people. They may be poor, they may be vulnerable, but they are highly affectionate people. I have been in Afghanistan for nearly 10 years with three different organizations. I started with Oxfam, then I went out to Bangladesh, Sudan, Iraq. But now and then I came back to Afghanistan. I came back with ActionAid as a country director. Then when I finished, I went out for some time. Then I came back with World Vision as the national director. So this journey has really helped me to see how every person is so beautiful and how much they can offer to the society. That's the feeling that began to be developed as part of my journey that started in Afghanistan.
And tell me about that work. What were you actually doing in Afghanistan? What was a typical year for you there?
Yeah, when I started in 2009, it was setting up more a team for Oxfam Novib because Novib really needed a physical presence in Afghanistan. So I was there trying to establish that kind of a team. And we were working through partners. So a lot of long-term programs we had, apart from doing humanitarian work. We had a lot of food security programs, education programs, livelihood initiatives for women. It was a quite an enriching experience because that was in the with the previous governments and we could do a lot of things.
Mm.
And I could see how women were so happy, empowered to contribute to their countries. I used to be interacting with so many MPs, women MPs, lawyers, doctors, especially gynecologists, wonderful women. So that really showed me how this country can progress when women are taken alongside.
Yes, you're a very big advocate for women and girls. That was a lot of your work in all the places you've been. Tell us a bit more about that. What have you seen that gives you encouragement when you've worked with women and girls in places where it's difficult for them?
Most of the places, like whether it's in Bangladesh or India, Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq, most of the places, life for women are very difficult. And most of the time, it's not that they don't have skills and capacities, but they are not given that opportunity to use them. And wherever I have been, my only thing that I wanted to do was to give them that opportunity,
yeah.
To create those opportunities so that they are able to use their skills and capacities to come out of themselves. And that gives me a lot of hope and confidence that world can be a different place if women, all women all over the world can contribute whatever they have. And this is very visible in Afghanistan. I have seen many of my staff coming to me and saying, can we make some arrangements with our working hours so that we can take up some other additional courses? So they were just trying to explore opportunities to keep growing. And that's what I thought. If we just trigger women to do something, they will move on and move on and move on to reach heights.
Mm.
And only we have to give that trigger point and find out that. So I have been happy that I got that opportunity to bring that kind of opportunity for women.
When you're working in Afghanistan, the background there is the war is going on. What were the ways in which life was impacted by that for you and the people you were working with?
Yeah, when the war was going on, it was like having two governments. One is this elected government and one was areas where Taliban or the present de facto government was powerful. When I was working for World Vision, I worked before Taliban taking over and during and after Taliban taking over. So it was a continuous journey kind of a thing. And what I experienced was sometimes we couldn't really visit all the places because it was highly dangerous to go to places which were occupied by the Taliban. And we knew the needs were quite high. But we took a bold stand of reaching out to the places, to those places. And I must really say, it was really possible because of the strong Afghan colleagues. They were so passionate to work for their communities. So they would say, okay, even if it is dangerous, let's go, because there are vulnerable children, they are women, they need health services, they need real nutritional services. So they really gave me a lot of support and strength to go on with the programs. And I think as World Vision, we were able to reach out to many inaccessible places in Afghanistan because of such strong Afghan team, which I really feel proud of. And that really helped us to scale up the programs. And even when Taliban took over, we were there.
Yeah.
We never left the country. So we said we will stand by the people. And that made a lot of change. People felt that we were with them during the most crucial moments.
This is Life and Faith, and I'm speaking with Asuntha Charles. Asuntha has for decades been a humanitarian worker and advocate for women and girls in places like Afghanistan and India. She works for World Vision and is now out of Afghanistan, but continuing her work with a single focus and commitment. And she talks with such passion and compassion, especially when it comes to children. Her work has shifted recently to the Middle East and the crisis there. She's certainly not someone who avoids challenging places. Here she is again.
I managed the Middle East crisis for World Vision for 3 months. It's just for a short term because we were trying to explore how the work would shape up, because it's a, as you rightly said, it's a very challenging context. And actually, it has turned out to be a national office program. So we had restructured the whole thing. For me, the whole Middle East crisis was a real highlight to see how in every conflict, it's the women and the children are the most affected ones. And as a very normal human being, my heart really breaks when I see children suffer. And especially when they really stand in long queues for food and there's no water for them and they are shivering in the cold and they're just getting wet in the rain. It breaks my heart. And I really think we need to wake up and do something. And it's not only in Gaza. In most of the places where there is war, either in Syria or Ukraine, my heart breaks to see what's going to happen to the future of these children. What's the impact of this war? Are they going to grow as children who can love and be affectionate to the communities, to the world? Or is it going to be hatred that's going to be there? Sometimes it's painful. But all that I want to do is to be hopeful that someday the world will see peace. And I think we, each one of us, has a role to play in that. And I hope we can do that in a proper way, because sometimes we also fade away from that kind of an opportunity. But I would really feel that everybody should make use of that opportunity to create peace in the world today.
You rightly point out here that we don't often enough think about the implications of children being in terrible situations and what that means for everyone down the track. There's a way in which looking after children forms health and functionality and good things for communities years later. And
yeah,
that's perhaps not given enough attention.
Yeah. I don't look at just children suffering without food for time being. I'm just worried about the future of these children with no education opportunities. For me, I can't really think of any child's dream not being realized. I always believe every child is so beautiful. And every child comes to the world with a beautiful dream. And each life has a purpose. And with this conflict, we are really shaking them. And we are making sure that those dreams are just expiring very soon, which we cannot afford to.
It felt like for a decade or more, we were making really good progress in terms of especially extreme poverty and overcoming that. How's that going now? Are we still doing well on this front or not?
I think a lot of things changed after COVID.
Right.
Because that complete shutdown also changed a lot of mindset of people. Like now when I look at it, I think we have slowed down a bit. And when I look around, the conflicts are increasing. And yes, it's never ending.
That then causes all sorts of knock-on effects, right?
And also, like, we are not really giving so much of focus to climate justice today. But that's highly crucial. So for me, I think it's the right time that we have to wake up again to say we are not going in the right direction. We have to speed up.
More attention. So we've sort of lost focus, perhaps, in these areas, perhaps become a bit complacent.
Yeah. Because we are supposed to be accomplishing our sustainable development goals by 2030. But even when you look at the world around, I'm just worried whether we will be able to do that, whether there's no hunger, no illiteracy is going to happen. Because when I was looking at a report published recently, which says that 110 million young women and girls will be out of school by 2030, that really shakes me.
Mm.
It's a huge number. That shows that we have to really speed up and do something better to meet those goals. Not only to meet those goals, but to really, really support these most vulnerable people. This is the urgent need.
You have you give off a sense that you've remained sort of energetic and positive about what can be achieved. Has your faith had some sort of impact on that in terms of keeping you hopeful in this work, which must sometimes become overwhelming?
Yeah, it's overwhelming. And I have really felt strengthened by my faith life and supportive friends. I have good friends who support me and encourage me. But one thing keeps me always encouraging and giving hope. That was a dream of an Afghan girl that I heard when I first went to Afghanistan. I was playing with many children because we used to have a sponsorship program in the children who were living in the caves. When I was just asking them, what's your dream for future? Like after finishing your studies, they were very small, like they were just 8, 9. So I was asking them, what do you want to become when you grow up? As usual answers like doctors, nurses, teachers, which is very typical of women roles in Afghanistan. But one girl stood up and said, I think I want to be the first woman president of Afghanistan. It was a shocking response. So when I asked her, like, do you know what you mean by that? I thought she's just jokingly just saying without knowing what she meant by that role. She said, no, I know what I want to do when I become a president. I would really have good schools for my children. I will make sure that all Afghan children have good quality education, good hospitals, good roads, good food, no malnutrition, no death of children. So that dream keeps resounding in my ears when I feel hopeless. That dream gives me a kind of a push to see that is not a dream of an Afghan girl. That should become a dream of every single person who is passionate about children and women in the society. So that gives me a lot of hope and courage to say, no, I have to move on. I have to see that at one point of time, every society that is affected by conflict is able to have a stronger voice from the vulnerable population. And I think towards that dream, I want to run and walk and jump all that I can do so that that dream can be a reality one day. And I want to see wherever there are oppression of women, women leadership can be there in those countries. And that's the dream that I want to spread across with stronger women to say, come and join me. Let's make sure that such leadership exists.
We often hear that if you help women in places where life is vulnerable, that has the best impact, like it has a sort of oversized impact. Why is that? And has that been your experience?
Yeah, working in the humanitarian sector, I have learned a lot from women. One beautiful thing is women can be gentle, but at the same time, they are very strong. And they are very empathetic. They understand people much better. They feel with them. And that's very, very essential for a leader. And today, I strongly believe we need such empathetic leaders for the world. And that's why investing in women will be so helpful, because they can bring everybody together. They can bring the children together. They can bring the elders together. They are people-oriented persons. And today, our leaders need to be people-oriented. That's what I strongly believe. If we invest in women, there can be change. because they believe in people. They don't believe in power, they don't believe in money, but they believe that people are their resources. And with them, we can do wonders.
Now, you've been here in Australia touring around and speaking to, well, particularly speaking to women. What have you been encouraging those women with and maybe challenging them with?
I have been telling them, just asking them, are we doing sufficient? Because we are really struggling with huge numbers of people who are facing food insecurity, especially women and girls. And we are seeing that many girls and boys are out of schools and many are in the conflict areas. That shows somewhere the resources are not used properly. Maybe somebody is using more resources and somebody is deprived. And I always thought the world is not a bad place. It's really turning into be a challenging place because good people are not doing the right thing. They are not able to take decisions that will help them to challenge the injustice that's happening. So I was asking the women, can we do little more than what we are doing now? Can we start sharing resources? Can we really advocate? Because you have the privilege of being in Australia and you have all the resources possible. So can we really advocate with the government for increased humanitarian aid to the places which are affected? And today, what is disappointing is the humanitarian aid is going down. And this cannot happen. So that's what I was challenging them to see, whether they can really, first of all, change themselves and also become a voice for the voiceless and continue to advocate with the government for doing the right thing.
When I talk to you, I'm a little feeling a bit self-conscious here because you must come from and you've been working amongst people who are really desperately poor, and then you come to a place like this, which is so, as you say, well-resourced and, you know, wealthy. What's it personally like for you just to have that contrast of those two experiences? Is it a difficult thing for you to process? Does it cause you angst when you've had to sort of experience those very vastly different environments?
Yeah, actually last time when I came to Australia from Afghanistan, I had to talk to different teams. And one thing that I raised as a big concern was the bottles of water that was kept everywhere. I thought that was a big luxury. And some people just drank one mouth and just left the water, and that water was really going to be wasted. So I said, can we just avoid this? Because when I see water getting wasted, when I see food getting wasted, it pains me a lot. Because I know there are millions of people all over the world have nothing to eat. Because I have seen some families in Afghanistan eating those thrown out baby carrots for breakfast, lunch and dinner. They have nothing to eat. And I have seen how malnourished children were dying because there was no food. So when I see a table full of food and the food is not taken as it should be and get wasted, it pains me a lot. And the same with water, because some people have no water to drink. And we have the luxury to just throw away water because we couldn't drink it fully. So I have really gone through a lot of such painful moments. But one thing that I've made sure is, like, at least I start practicing not to waste food, not to waste water. And that really gives me at least a little bit of consolation that I will not change even when I travel from a real difficult country to a real resourceful country. I will stay with my own conviction. And somewhere I will try to also promote to other people so that people are careful about what they have and also appreciate what they have so that there are no kind of complaints that we don't have things.
Yes, the sense of understanding your privilege and then your responsibilities. I suppose for the person who's been brought up in this sort of country and it's pretty well-resourced and so on, what's your message to that person?
First of all, I would say, appreciate life. Appreciate all that you have, because you are blessed in many ways. And once you accept that you are blessed, you also are open to see out of yourself. And then you are beginning to see what's happening around the world, and you see there is so much of need. And then with that acceptance, you're more and more open to look at things in a different way and start supporting people with different causes. So unless you have this acceptance, supporting people becomes very difficult because you start craving for things. And then you don't look at the world as it is now. So one thing is appreciate life and also start looking at the world. Sometimes we become so selfish that I'm happy, I have everything. My life ends like that. But I don't think we can be self-sufficient today because the world needs more people to be generous. Because there's so much of poverty, malnutrition, lack of healthcare services, so many things are there. For me, like if a child of 8 years enjoys every opportunity here in Australia and somewhere in Afghanistan or Syria and Ukraine, if that same age-old child suffers, that pains me a lot. The child has never done anything to go through such kind of pain. And maybe every religion says that God created the world. And so if we believe that, and I'm sure he wants us to be helpful to everyone so that their life becomes more and more happier one. So be happy with yourself and also try to see that you make other people happy, bring peace to them. Today, the world needs more good-hearted people who can take good decisions and implement those decisions. That can bring a lot of changes.
Now, from a very young age, you have been an advocate for people in vulnerable situations. Has that been a life of satisfaction for you?
Yes. When I look at my life, I always test myself to see whether I'm happy. And so far, I have found myself happy. When I started the career, I thought maybe this is my kind of a job that I want to do, to take care of myself, to take care of my parents. But now I see it's more and more, it's why I have been created. Maybe this is the way that I want to be. I have found my purpose in life. So this is for being a voice for the voiceless, and especially the vulnerable women and children. And I'm happy to do that. So wherever I go, I am passionate about these issues. And I really want to share so that at least one or two people, if they can really hear these messages and really feel like reaching out to people, I think the world can be a better place. And I would really want us to become solution-oriented people rather than just looking at the challenges and saying, I feel sad about what's happening in Syria. I'm sad about children in Ukraine. Yes, you feel sad, but do something. Do something to bring about change. We don't need words today. We need deeds that can change people's lives.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. A huge thanks to Asuntha Charles for coming into the studio during a very busy tour of duty here in Australia, travelling to all the capital cities with MICA Australia as they launched their A Safer World for All campaign. Please do send this episode on to someone who might appreciate it. It's good to get others into the Life and Faith community. And send us some feedback at podcast@publicchristianity.org. It's always good to hear from you. Life and Faith is just one of the many things we do here at CPX, and if you'd like to know more of what we do, go to publicchristianity.org and sign up to our newsletter. That'll keep you up to date with all that's going on here. Well, Life and Faith will be taking a break for a few weeks. We'll be planning and recording episodes for another bumper season, and we'll look forward to bringing that to you soon. Thanks, as always, to our producer, the always compassionate Alan Douthwaite. See you next time.